Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues, the music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shape modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
Blues fans, we're taking a trip. Grab your passport, metaphorically. Point it across the Atlantic and slip past the Straits of Gibraltar, steer straight into the heart of the Mediterranean. That's where you'll find Malta, sun-soaked crossroads of history, stone, salt air. Both roll up Mediterranean Nights by Andres Cantu. Yeah, that's it. Now, from that tiny island comes a trio you need to know about. They're called Vinyl Paradise. We've got Ben Bailey on guitar and vocals. He's the pretty one. Patrick Camilleri on drums. He keeps the groove. And Antoine Tona on bass. You gotta watch him. Together, they're Vinyl Paradise, a Maltese blues and blues rock power trio with a sound forged from a deep love of the genre and the skill to bend it their way. These three met in a previous outfit, the Creepers, a band dedicated to replicating vintage American blues. By about January 2017, they stuck it out on their own, forming Vinyl Paradise and sharpening their edge through years of festivals, clubs, sweaty concert nights across Malta and the UK. We're going to hear about some of those stories. Their musical education, once freely available to every Maltese child, perhaps it still is, wasn't just classroom theory. They were nurtured, encouraged, and in their case, pushed further by little sibling rivalry, parents who valued music as much as academics. It shows in the way they've blended the Three Kings, Cream, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Hendrix, Gary Clark Jr. into something unmistakably theirs. It's a blues, funk, rock and roll, soul kind of thing, locked into deep grooves and topped with 60s soul-inspired vocals. And by 2023, they were touring London and Kent with a live EP, Live at Winehouse, hitting legendary spots like the Troubadour, St. Moritz Club, Soho, the Bourne Music Club, and with their debut album written entirely by this band and recorded at David Vella's Temple Studios, they're not just Malta's number one blues export. They're ready for the global stage. And you're going to love the accents, too. Let's get into it now, right where I did. Tell me about the blues scene in Malta. What's going on there, guys?
I think you're looking at the majority of the blues scene in Malta. There are a couple of different bands here. But it is still pretty underground out here, and we trying to fly the flag high and loud, I suppose, you know, for blues. Play around the island a lot, play a little bit in mainland Europe and the UK, hopefully out in Canada soon, hopefully.
Yes.
But yeah, no, we're essentially trying to spread awareness and appeal for a sort of underappreciated genre out here.
Well, good on you. The blues needs spokesmen and men and women to carry the flag forward, absolutely, for sure. And we want to talk about what Vinyl Paradise is doing in Malta and worldwide as well, but we want to get to know the triumvirate here, the trio. Patrick, I'd like to start with you because you've got the drums beating there. Well, that's a phone. That's very unprofessional. Let me just stop that. I guess we'll just have to cut that out, won't we? So I want to talk to everybody about it, but Patrick, tell me about, if you can, tell me about the time when music first came on the horizon for you. Tell me about that, when that happened.
I grew up in a family where everyone played an instrument. And in Malta, traditionally, we usually have these local band clubs that children can go and learn an instrument, a brass instrument, usually. They are the most popular, for free. So my father used to play the trumpet with this local band, and my mother used to play the saxophone before they got married. So obviously we were listening to records which my father bought the 60s and 70s, like, I don't know, Boney M, Stevie Wonder. So we grew up listening to that kind of music, you know. And we always were drew to that kind of musical family, let's say, you know. And around the age of 7, I started playing the trumpet back then. And then we got Thierry, me and my brother, because I have a twin brother, started Thierry and piano, music theory and piano. At the age of around 15, 16, I wanted to play the trumpet. I actually started listening to rock, UK rock music, like Queen. And I got fascinated of seeing this Roger Taylor behind the drum kit. And my mother didn't really want me to play the drums.
No parent does.
But,
too much noise.
But after some time, I persuaded my father, and he told me, okay, I'll buy you a drum kit. Well, basically, then it actually, I went to London for a year as well, studied there for a diploma in performance, which I met really great artists as well over there, you know, and we still even have very good relationships with my ex-teachers. When I came back to Malta, then I met this guy who was from Holland, bluesman, blues guitarist, very good blues guitarist, who was living here in Malta. And he wanted to set up a blues band. And we got together to start this band, which was called that time the Creepers. And since then, I mean, I love the style, I love the groove, and there's where I met Antoine as well. We've been playing together for the last, I think, 15 years now.
Yes.
So yes, I mean, exactly. And it grew. I think, yes, we're doing a good job. I mean, you can listen as well to our last release, Vinyl Paradise album. And slowly we are getting even to Europe for now. And hopefully with our contacts now to Canada as well.
Very nurturing environment in terms of music. There was
yes.
Complimentary lessons available. You were encouraged to pursue
exactly,
this brass
yes.
and winds, but you were encouraged.
Exactly.
Not only by the community, but by your parents as well.
Yes, my parents were really on this, you know, every time. So I thank them.
And around the house, you were hearing Motown and R&B and British Invasion, yeah. 60s kind of stuff. That could, all of our parents were listening to that kind of
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
Pretty much. Okay. And you went through a number of instruments, but at one point you heard the drummer in Queen and you went, wait a minute, that's connecting on a somewhat deeper level here. That's making my blood boil just a little bit. Tell me about the time where you got past mom not wanting to hear the drums all the time. You convinced dad to get you that first set. What kind of drums were they?
I remember it was a very low-end Mapex drum kit. But for some reason, I sat behind the drums, and I could play a groove, not even knowing, you know, it was natural for me. Then obviously by time I got to, you know, reading and I worked on my coordination and stuff. But first time, and even I put it out of the boxes, and I could even know where the pieces have to go without anyone showing me, like, how to play or to set up a drum kit. It was natural, really, really natural for me. And obviously, as I told you, then I deepened my studies, you know, and, you know, reading music, reading drums and all that stuff.
That's a long road to,
yes.
to sit down at the kit with the sticks and say, well, I don't know anything yet. I mean, and then that's the elementary statement in learning is I don't know. And right, and then to
yeah.
take that in, and there must have been many, many hours in the woodshed picking up the rudiments and getting your timing down. That's the kind of mastery that goes into the musicianship that I know our listeners are really fascinated by. And so we appreciate your diligence in that to get you to that point. Now, I understand the other half of the rhythm section, Antoine is picking up the low end with the groove on the bass. So, Antoine, I want to hear, we're going to talk to Ben in a second because Ben's doing the singing and the crying, but I want to talk to Antoine because Antoine's got the low end groove going. And Antoine, tell me about your, now you grew up in Malta as well.
Yes, I'm Maltese. I grew up in Malta.
So same supportive environment then in terms of musicality and...
Yes, so I was 13 years old playing the bass. And my older sister, she got me into it because she bought a drum kit. And first thing she told me, don't touch it. If you want to play something, get another instrument. So she advised, like, get a bass and we can jam and learn together. Okay. And that's how it started. Well, she stopped playing, but I continued. That was a long time ago. I went to a teacher. I studied theoretically stuff for a year or two. But then in the 90s era, everything was coming on tabs. And it was like a bit easier to go on and off. But after a while, later on then, I went back to School of Music and I got the exams, all the necessary exams. And I finished School of Music. Now I stopped. I could have continued, but it was too much then. So I just was playing mostly with bands. And I come from a rock scene before playing with the Creepers and Patrick. But then when we met, it was 2009, and we started this band, The Creepers. It opened another world. The blues, the traditional blues we played, had a certain way of playing. I remember this Dutch guitar player used to tell me and Patrick on the rhythm section, you have to be lazy on that shuffle. But how lazy can you get? You know, you have to be on the one. And it was a good lesson. We learned how to get the good shuffle going. And that was distinguish a bit the blues we play here in Malta, at least, because not really many musicians got into this genre. I love it. We enjoy it. And I think we're doing pretty good because we find that people are engaging, even here in Malta, even youngsters. So we're on the good track, you know.
What kind of bass do you play?
Now I play a Fender. I got stuck to a Fender jazz bass, and that's my favorite. When I started back in the late 80s, 90s, I remember my mom and dad bought me a Status. It was a package, like you have a Trace Elliot amplifier, which I still have, and a Status. It was like a perfect pack. But that was the first bass guitar. Then I switched to Fender. Now lately I bought a Yamaha too, FBB series. I need to try that. I'm waiting for it.
It's coming in the
It's an experiment.
I started on a P bass and found that my hands just weren't big enough. And I got onto the jazz bass and I, all of a sudden, oh, that's the catcher's mitt right there. And so, I've been on the deluxe jazz ever since. Thick or thin strings, Antoine?
Medium. I go always for the medium, basically. Sometimes I tried, when we played the traditional blues stuff with the Creepers, I tried even the flat ones. They sounded more low. But basically now I use the normal strings, not the flat ones. But I find that the rosewood neck is more appealing for me, to be honest, rather than the maple. I don't know what about you.
You know what? I typically grab a medium. I switched from acoustic guitar because I couldn't take the pain. I went to jazz bass because I like to play, but I like to play more than I like the pain. So, that's I like a light string and turn it up high so I don't have to work too hard. We are enjoying a chat with blues sensation out of Malta, Vinyl Paradise. And we have Patrick laying down the beat. We've got Antoine laying the low end on the groove, but in the middle we have Ben. And Ben not only makes the guitar sing, but he shares some vocals with us as well. Ben, you've been sitting pretty in the middle, quiet this whole time. We appreciate it. But tell me, I want to know your story, Ben. So tell me about the first time that you had an instrument in your hands. Where were you? Tell me about the scene there.
Well, a big influence on my musical, or I suppose the beginning of my musical journey, was my brother. Growing up, he's quite a lot older than me. He's 13 years older than me. And he used to play a lot of piano around the house while he was still at home. So I would hear him sort of woodshedding and finding ideas and so on there. But obviously, I was so young, it never occurred to me. It didn't occur to me, full stop. You know how it is when you're little, you're thinking of other things. But one Christmas, when I was living in Australia, I was 9. He was living in Melbourne at the time. We were in Sydney. And he came up and he brought me a Christmas present. He bought me Guitar Hero, that video game with the buttons and the guitar-shaped controller. And I fell in love with this game. I absolutely adored it. So much so, even when I wasn't playing it, we'd be sitting as a family watching TV, I had the controller on my lap. There's something I liked about the feeling of a guitar right away. And then some good fortune struck. A teacher at my school started teaching guitar after school. And it turned out he was a bit of a local blues guitar legend, like in and around the towns where we were. I'd love for him to see this. Mr. Barker, Ian Barker, he was a fantastic, great guitarist. I hope he's doing well. But he started me off on blues because he was a blues guy. The group very quickly went from being about 12 kids to me, just me. And I got one-on-one with this fantastic blues guitarist. And I was sort of, my dad raised me on Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale, Creedence Clearwater, Tracy Chapman. So I sort of had a bit of blues mixed in there. So when I was being shown Buddy Guy and B.B. King and Albert King and then Steve Ray Vaughan, like it was very much, you could say it was fate in that way. Everything sort of lined up really well, really well.
So the class probably dwindled because learning guitar sounds sexy until you have to start going through the motions and showing up every day and running your scales and your shapes and such. So, okay, so pretty soon it was just you and was it Mr. Parker?
Mr. Barker, yeah.
Mr. Barker, as in Carnival Barker, got it. Okay, so you had a local blues man. And he was able to focus his all his genius on you because you were the sole student. So you were able to absorb that on a very concentrated level. And so your brother was around tickling the ivories every once in a while. So you were hearing that, and that was sort of making sense to you. Your dad was bringing J.J. Cale into the picture, Eric Clapton. So you had a very, very solid blues kind of foundation there. And tell me about the time where you went from Guitar Hero to real Guitar Hero. I mean, there was a point where you traded your joystick for your axe, as it were. Tell me how that began. And I want to hear about the early woodshed moments from when you first picked it up and you went, whoa, to the incredible virtuosity you display on stage these days. Not trying to butter you up, but I've watched you play. So tell us.
Thank you, first of all. But I picked it up rather quickly and naturally. I think I had maybe developed an ear already for the style, having been raised on it. So without knowing, I could tell you how something should sound and shouldn't sound. You know, I knew what I wanted. I sort of had an ethereal idea of what I wanted, whatever I was playing to sound like. You know, so I always had a direction. I had direction from right away. And I would, when this teacher started giving lessons, I told my mum and dad, I was like, hey, can I start taking lessons? They said, that's fantastic. In fact, at the time, I was a young sort of budding tennis champion. So, I dropped tennis altogether for the guitar. Like, I still need to get back into it, to be fair. but I got this guitar. My mum and my auntie took me to the guitar shop, Engadine Music. And we spoke to Mike at the counter, who's now the manager. Right? It's like 17 years later. And he, He sold me this Spanish acoustic guitar, and from the first couple of lessons, I remember I'd come home right away and just spend hours just doing whatever it is that Mr. Barker had showed me. If it was something as simple as a D chord and an A, you know, I'd just play that over and over. And by the time I could change chords, he was teaching me the 12-bar blues. You know, I was doing like 1-4-5 progressions, and he was teaching me, you know, the pentatonic scales. He sort of, I think he saw a little spark in me and was very, very good getting it out of me, because I was so enthusiastic the 2 years I spent learning from him. That flame never sort of went out. He kept it burning. And I probably drove my parents and neighbors absolutely crazy, totally up the wall with the amount of guitar I would play. It was unhealthy, probably. Just so much playing, you know, so much playing guitar. Yeah.
I think that's a key insight, though. When you're a teenager, there's a lot of angst there, and you're going to shoot your energy in some direction. You focused it. And for you, it was an expression of passion. This wasn't a labor for you. This was an expression. And with the right guidance, you were able to hone it into a craft that now you can tell that you get pleasure from. And that's a rare thing for people to learn a discipline and then not only to get pleasure from it, but to give pleasure to others also. And so I think that's a real insight for people to know that the mastery comes from that woodshed approach, that you sat and you played that D chord for a day and a half or 2 days before you got to the C chord, before you got to 1-4-5 or the 12-bar blues, but you got it down and now you have it. And that was how many years ago? So good for you. Now the singing aspect of it, you've also got a great sound. How did that come about? Was that a guided scenario, or was it just sort of, you know what, I know the lyrics, I put up and let it go? Tell me how that came about.
It was a really interesting, not really interesting actually, I have a very vivid memory of it. So I started playing guitar at 9-10 years old. 2 years into that, I was like playing at a level where I wanted to perform. And I just remember my dad having a, while I was in the living room after school, I was still in my school uniform. My dad was at home at that point in time, and we were chatting about something, and I was holding my guitar. And it's funny you mentioned Queen, because he chucked the stereo on and a crazy little thing called Love was playing. And I was sort of jamming along with it. And he stopped it and he said, you know, if you ever want to be the leader of a band, you're going to need to sing as well. And I remember I think it was Crazy Little Thing Called Love I sort of just like started singing along to. And then I quickly formed a little high school band and we started playing, and I was the singer. And so really I've been, from about 12 or 13, I've been in bands and trying to front bands. I think that first band, we were mainly an AC/DC and Guns N' Roses cover band. So,
as all first band should be.
Absolutely. It's a rite of passage.
Exactly. Rite of passage.
Yeah.
And it made perfect sense to you, because Dad said, listen, son, you're going to be in a band, you're going to be the leader, you're going to be the singer. Yeah. And so that just made sense. You didn't question it. You said, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And here you are.
Yeah, it did make sense.
Early influences are very important.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, I want to jump around a little bit. Patrick, tell me about the top three songs on your electronic jukebox these days. If you're traveling on the bus or on the plane or whatever, and you're not talking to these guys, what's on the Walkman? Boy, that dates me. What's on the MP3 player?
Well, I don't. That's very difficult for me to answer, because I listen to a lot of different genres, not just the blues. But I think John Mayer would be my first choice.
Wow,
he's amazing.
He's very amazing. Talented guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, Antoine, I'm sorry, Patrick, please continue. You had another thought and I cut you off. Please continue.
No, I had other thoughts, but like I listen to any kind of blues artist. Like, I mean, my favorites are obviously All the Kings, B.B. King, Albert King, even when, especially when the blues or the soul, that kind of soul blues music has brass in it. I love that sound of the brass. Like, for example, when you listen to Albert King.
Like Born Under a Bad
Born
Sign.
Born Under a Bad Sign, that for hook, example. That hook of that brass. I really love that kind of sound. And yeah. Considering at that time, you know, they recorded live and everyone is one just in one room. And you hear all the talent. It's amazing. No layers, nothing, just one mic and boop, and you have to play what you have to play.
Okay, Antoine, I'm going to grab your headphones and I want to know what's playing when you're on the tour bus or on the plane.
So lately, the latest at least, our friend we mentioned, the Dutch bloke we had in the Creepers, Steven van der Naat, he released an album too with his band, Little Steve and the Big Beat.
Yeah.
And we swapped albums when he was here.
Yeah.
So I was listening to that mostly the last couple of weeks.
Circles, isn't it?
Circles, yeah, the album is Circles.
Yeah.
Then, sometime before, I bought an LP of R.L. Burnside. I don't know. He's an old bluesman.
Yeah.
And I got curious last year, I think, Slash from Guns N' Roses did a blues album. So I go, what's going around in circles?
You mentioned the song from that.
I mentioned the song to cover it up as well. So those are the three latest things I was listening to. Yeah, it's interesting. And
so if we want to get Vinyl Paradise, here's a link where you can get your music right now, guys. This is a clickable link. We'll leave it on the screen for a few seconds. Just while we're talking about Ben, give me your song of the moment. I know mine changes almost day to day. Obscure numbers because I've been around forever, but your song of the moment, brother.
Song of the moment. I can say right away, and this goes back to what I was chatting about earlier, which is the music I was raised on. It would have to be one of two. I'm going to give you two here because they're pretty equal in my mind right now. Both by J.J. Cale. Call the Doctor and Cajun Moon. Mm. And I can say that because I have this funny thing. I listen to a lot of music. I do listen to a lot of soul and blues too. I also listen to some crazier stuff like Tame Impala and the Black Pumas are really great at the moment. But if I'm ever writing, I have to only listen to J.J. Cale records, and I don't know why. If I'm going to be writing music, the only thing, if I either listen to no music at all, or I listen to only.
It's an alarm. I'm sorry.
Popular guys, I have a request for a booking coming in.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
Oh, Glastonbury. I have to take the pills.
Glastonbury.
Fantastic. Yes. Glastonbury, yes, we'll
take it. The festival. Exactly. Sorry.
It's the manager. He wants a bigger percentage.
Yeah.
So.
J.J. Cale. A riff master.
He's unreal.
Pretty solid. It's pretty solid numbers. I mean, Eric Clapton was covering. Yeah. Leonard Skinner did a great job on Call Me Breeze.
Yeah.
Okay, so J.J. Cale is
Exactly. I read recently, I think the first album of his was Naturally, and I think I saw an excerpt from the review when it was first released in one of the magazines, and someone had said, it's a wonderful mixture of boogie, country, and blues played about as slowly as the human metabolism can handle, which I really, really loved. But yeah, for some reason, it just speaks to me. I have to listen to that, otherwise I can't write.
That kind of ties into Antoine's concept about how slowly can you play the shuffle, right? I mean, slow it down.
Yeah.
We do play some slow blues. Sometimes it's hard for the audience, but we still chuck them in our set, you know.
Yeah.
We have to. And they appreciate them. We did a good gig lately, and slow blues was appreciated as well.
Yeah, they might get antsy at first, but you'll suck them in with your grooves. They'll understand. Sure. They'll be up on the dance floor in no time. Guys, Tell me about the strangest gig you ever played. I mean, like the nuttiest one.
Strangest one that we've played as a band, because we all play with lots of other bands too, and I've played some really wild ones.
You know what? Let's talk to each of you, and each of you give me the strangest gig. Together or separately?
I have.
Patrick, you go first.
No.
Didn't we play one?
You have too many? The strangest.
Didn't we play one? The strangest. We played one with Sven once, and they had like strippers that came out.
Yes. This was, I think. It was an event that I think it was a biker event, a charity event.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend was there as well.
Where all of a sudden?
Well, so we didn't know about this. Yeah. We didn't really know about this.
Yeah.
And we started playing. Normally, obviously, everyone is having drinks and stuff. And then suddenly, these four blonde girls came out. I think they had a two-piece. It was an American flag.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Yes, that's right. The Confederate flag. That's right.
Oh, my God. We remember.
And they just came in front of the drums. Like, and I was trying not to look. My ex-girlfriend now was on my left side, like looking through a window, and I was like trying to look at her, not to look on this side.
Yeah.
But we were smiling. I mean...
Yeah, that was a nice surprise, I must say.
Yeah,
that's
very
funny. I played so many gigs that
we played in London at this when we played at that place.
You made it through, Patrick. Yes, you made it through that gig. Okay, Ben.
Yeah.
Let's hear the strangest one. Yeah, that one in the hopper.
Sorry. I've got a few funny ones. I personally, with some other bands, I was invited to. I played this gig once, and they sort of grabbed musicians from different bands and made some band for the night, and I was the guitarist in this band. And I had just played a wedding, and that finished at like 11 p.m., and then this other one started at 1 a.m., and big group of like Spanish musicians and like all of their entourages decided to rent out like a bastion in Malta, protected, and have like a pirate themed party in there, and it was the wildest. That was the weirdest one I've played. People jumping up on stage and stopping the music every now and then to talk about how great everyone on stage is, and then starting us up again. Wild. We finished at like 4 a.m. It was grueling. It was grueling. We were all
no intoxicants drunk. Allowed there. I'm sure there's no intoxicants involved in that.
No, not at all.
Okay, Antoine. We know yours is going to be the nastiest. You go ahead.
All right. Strange there were, but probably the strangest. Before I didn't use in-ears, and that was good. When I started using in-ears, I was feeling strange when playing. You know, you're just like in a bubble.
You're a bit cut off, yeah.
And that was strange, not in a nice way, but then I got used to them. Then the rest, you know, we had these parties, we had the strippers, we had everything falling down whilst playing, and people hurt themselves, you know. Yeah. I always say to be careful, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I had one. I remember.
That's what I can tell.
We were playing, I don't know if you were playing, but we had this, in Malta we have this annual beer festival, so that's huge, and we were playing... I think it was the last night. And we had this singer who had one song. It was in the beginning of the set. And then he had another song at the end of the set. So in between, he was drinking.
Yeah, remember.
he came on stage like an hour and a half later when we started. Drunk, like... And he was singing AC/DC, I think. And we couldn't stop because he was singing the refrain all over and all over again. And suddenly, you know where the stage. So you have this stage, and you have the bass bins
underneath
the stage.
Yeah.
He jumped. He thought he's going to land on the bass bins. He missed, and he went onto the crowd.
Oh my God!
So people were trying to lift him up.
Well,
alcohol, you know, it's...
yeah. These things happen. So,
when you guys go to a gig, you always have a set list, but Do you customize it for the gig? Does it? Do you have a look at the crowd and say, oh, okay, we're going to go this way, we're going to go that way? Yeah, how do you approach that?
I think we try to judge. Sometimes when you're putting the set together, you're not listening to every song in its entirety back to back to put that set list together. You're sort of guessing, you're going, oh, you know, this song, that song, and you're trying to change the groove every now and then, create a bit of a, this is a climax and then a bit of a drop here. And every now and then it doesn't work. When you're actually out there at the gig, you've played song six and song seven is about to drop, but you felt during song six, everyone's getting ramped up and you go, okay, maybe now isn't the time to drop it. Let's skip that one, replace it with that song. Uh-huh. And we're also quite casual about it. I know and work with bands where they always have a talk back microphone that just goes to the in-ears and there's a lot of silently talking to each other. I don't like that. I like having the audience in on the, if we go, let's skip that one, or how does this one start? I like that because it, especially if we're like, not to brag, but I think we're tight when we play. And I like the conversation between, you know, songs to be, so what are we going to do? How does that song start again? Because then there's a lot more impact when it's actually rock solid.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It feels really off the cuff, but still well presented. But I think that's
It's very real. You know, if you turn to Antoine and say, can we make it a little faster on this one? We're going to, do you want to do that one? Okay, let's do it. Yeah, that's very real for the audience. They get to participate there and then they feel included. So, you know, that's awesome. And again, like you say, if you're planning, I mean, it's not unlike a DJ who approaches a scene to adjust the mood up and down. You get them up, get them dancing. Let's have a slow dance. Get them to the bar, get them back out. You're really doing the same thing. You're conducting the mood. And so you're saying, if you see them one way and you want to get them the other way, you know, just drop this song. Let's get another fast one in here to keep the tempo going. And it's not like you go, you communicate openly on the stage.
Yeah, there's no secrets. And
I think the audience would enjoy that. I think I would. If I was sitting in the front, I would feel included. You know, if you say, let's do Red House instead, you know. Yeah.
I love that. I love that interaction as an audience member. I think there's a, when I see a talk back, I get an impression of ego. And I know that might not even be the case. Like those people on stage might be lovely people. And I know that working with people alone, but there's this sort of, it's like being in a conversation of four people and three of them turn their back on the other. It feels rude. It's like, you know, come on, you know, we're all in the room together. And I would like to carry that through even, you know, into huge audiences. Hopefully that we can have. I like the personal touch in there.
I think that makes for a very inclusive atmosphere. Uh-huh. Even in a big stadium, I think you can still pull that off. I mean, they're watching you on the monitors or what have you.
Yeah.
I was going to talk about the blues scene in Malta, but you kind of straightened me out there, saying like, you guys are the blues scene in Malta for the most part.
it might have been a bit of a blanket statement. Like, we're not necessarily the whole. There are lots of cool acts popping up where they have some blues numbers and some where I can definitely see that there's a bit of an influence that we've had over the years on the scene. But yeah, in terms of bands where that's their whole MO, I can really only think of a handful, and even those, they play a couple of blues numbers in their show and really do still do the quote-unquote same covers that you hear everywhere else. Like, even if we're covering an artist who's covered very often, like Hendrix, right? Rather than playing Hey Joe, you know, we'd prefer to do Manic Depression or, you know, Wait Until Tomorrow. Like maybe the stuff, or Stone Free, stuff that's just a little off the beaten path. You know, when you say Hendrix, everyone's thinking of the same couple of songs. You know, so we might play like Freddie King. You know, instead of playing Going Down, we'll play I'm Tore Down. You know, it's just a little off the beaten path. So it makes it a bit different, but it's still all blues,
You throw an album cut in for the real fans, you know, not just the top 40 stuff. Okay, so that's a real blues experience. That's because blues fans don't listen to top 40. We put on the album and just kind of go in, you know. Yeah. Album, again, that we date ourselves there. CD, MP3, whatever the case may be. Any gigs coming up, guys? Any big gigs coming up we want to talk about?
We're going to the UK in October.
October, yeah.
We already have 2 dates, and we're planning to have more dates, and obviously maybe some bookings, as maybe you know as well, in Canada.
That'd be fantastic. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Very fun.
So when you guys show up at a gig and you're doing a sound check, what's the song?
Actually, I can point to it specifically. So we like to play Crossroads, right?
Yeah.
By Cream in the set. And we play a couple of different versions. We play like the straight version, the classic, da 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 da, right? But there's a version John Mayer did once at a show. I think it was to sort of save his voice a little bit because it pitched it a bit lower. But he played it as a shuffle. So we switch up what we do at the gig. Sometimes we play the shuffle, sometimes we play the straight. But whichever one we're going to do, we do the other version of the sound check. So that if anyone's there in earshot, or sometimes you're setting up in front of other patrons in the bar because it was open earlier that day. So we're not just... we're not going to play that song and they go, oh yeah, that's the one they did for sound check. You know? So I think it's a good approach.
Keeping it fresh. Yeah. Even for the eager ones that come for sound check, boy, that's getting your money's worth there.
Exactly. Yeah, they get like an alternate version. It's brilliant. Yeah.
Anybody else that we should keep our eyes on? Any up and comers like yourselves or that maybe have learned from you off the Malta scene?
That's small.
I think of Isaac. What's his band called?
They're very
Road,
young.
Road.
I forgot the name of the band, but we have there's this young kid. He's still 16.
Reload.
Yeah, they're all the same age. 16, 17. Reload.
Yeah. Reload. Yeah. His guitar. There's something going on there. You know, even the first time I heard him play, I think he was playing Sting. A song from Sting, I think.
Yeah.
But he was still 15, 14, 15.
Yeah.
He was sound checking before us, and I said this kid is going to be the next thing here in Malta, I think.
He was playing with another band,
yes.
But they have a blues trio
And now they started a blues. He started a blues trio as well, and they're doing very well, I think. He's really, really, really good.
He is fantastic. And by the way, Isaac, if you watch this podcast, you keep messaging me on Instagram, please keep doing it. I can't make it to a show yet because every time you have a gig, I have a gig, but I will make it, all right? So please keep messaging me. He's a good kid and a great guitarist. Yeah.
And when you're done messaging Ben, you can message Matt over at Talking Blues because we'd love to have you on the show.
Very good. Exactly.
We've been in conversation with Vinyl Paradise, rock and blues trio out of Malta. Gentlemen, thank you kindly for gracing our studios today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. We would love
to have you back on and hear about your exploits.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.